Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Marty Goldenson, in for Brian. Well, it's been about a year and a half since Lehman Brothers went bust and the country's banking system nearly imploded. Lots has been written about this road to ruin, blaming greed on Wall Street and mad lending on Main Street. But now, with Michael Green, Matthew Bishop has written The Road from Ruin, How to Revive Capitalism and Put America Back on Top. He says the old capitalism is dead and it's time to design a new one, this one with new global rules and personal ethics. Matthew Bishop, who is business editor, I guess U.S. business editor for The Economist, joins us. Good morning.
Good morning.
So am I one of the few people who didn't misread the title and think it said The Road to Ruin?
Well, you're right. It is The Road from Ruin. There's so many books out there that are all about the blow-by-blow account of what went wrong and who did what to whom. But this is actually a book that attempts to chart a road out of the crisis. And we have a whole load of ideas about how we can improve our capitalism, because we believe that what happened in 2008 revealed real fundamental problems with the system that still haven't been fixed. And so we still worry that we could be back with another mess before we've even got out of this one.
Yeah, before we go into those specifics, one of the reasons the book is engaging is that it draws on history, things that happened 200 years ago or 250. Tell us the lesson from tulips, for example.
Well, you're right. We did one of the things we wanted to understand was how we got into this mess, not just in the months before it happened, but to look back at all the previous bubbles and crashes and depressions and recessions, right the way back to tulip mania, which happened in Holland in the 17th century, when people speculated wildly about what color different tulip bulbs would turn out to be, and what price you'd pay for those different tulip bulbs. And now, on the face of it, this is famously one of the most mad bubbles in history. But when you dig beneath the surface, it turns out that one of the reasons this was such a sport in Holland was that actually the futures contracts were available for the first time, where you could actually agree a price for something that would be delivered years or months in the future. And so people started to actually trade those for the first time, and I think they got carried away because they didn't really figure out how to use them properly and how to. And that's one of the lessons of actually other bubbles, is there tends to be some kind of innovation that goes on that we get carried away by.
A new kind of market.
A new kind of market, new kind of instrument, like paper money when that first came in, and treasury bonds when they first came in. They had bubbles in those areas as well. And I think one of the lessons for today is how do we figure out what were the useful innovations that contributed to the bubble that happened, and how do we make sure we keep the best things that were going on without repeating the excesses of the past.
Right. And the other parallel, I guess, to the bubble is that it draws lots of money into some market. Huge amounts of money, but there's actually no value underneath. Is that also the parallel?
Well, I think with a bubble, you always get more money coming in than is justified. So you do get the prices of the instrument going way ahead of what they ought to be. But actually, some good can come out of that. So if you remember the dot-com bubble at the end of the 1990s, I mean, in the end, a lot of rubbish was being sold that was worth absolutely nothing. But in the process, a lot of capital was thrown at what has turned out to be one of the most important sectors of the economy. And as a result, I think probably we discovered what worked.
Right, and right there
much more
is
quickly
the danger
than we might have done. Yeah.
Right there is the danger that you and your co-author are worried about, that there'll be some kind of regulation that'll make it that will say, don't throw money at things, look at the dot-com bubble, the negative part, but not the positive part. That's your worry, no?
That's right. We have worries both ways. One is that not enough will be done, and that seems to be the current mood in Washington. The other is that there will be excessive regulation. So there's a real concern that, for example, some of these subprime mortgage derivatives that got talked about that seem very complicated, actually they did allow a lot of people who wouldn't have been able to get a mortgage in the past to buy their home for the first time. Now, by the end, a lot of people who shouldn't have been lent money under any circumstances were being lent money. But in the early days of the instrument, this was a positive innovation. And what you want to make sure is that we don't, by being overprotective, over-regulatory, kill the golden goose.
So what do you think of what's being done so far, what Dodd is doing from Connecticut, what the president has proposed, this idea of a consumer protection finance. Are they on the right track in Washington?
Well, I think some of what's being talked about at the moment makes a bit of sense. Only a bit of sense. I mean, I do feel there's a lack of understanding of how big a crisis this is for our capitalist system, that we've revealed, this bubble bursting has revealed real flaws in the system that require us to step out of the past ideological positions, which I think are guiding a lot of people in Washington, to actually say, well, how can we improve the system in fundamental ways?
People are underreacting.
They're underreacting in terms of the degree to which we need to change.
Well, let's talk about that. Yeah. What's been exposed besides that bubbles happen? Are you thinking of the globalization question? Or?
So one thing that's been exposed is that our global institutions of managing capitalism are not up to scratch. Things like the IMF and the World Bank and even having the dollar as a reserve currency for the world. Those worked well in the second half of the 20th century, but they're not really suited for now. Another area that's a problem is, you know, we're all saving for our retirement through pension funds and mutual funds. It turns out most of those companies and pension funds have taken very little interest in how the companies they invest in are run. They don't vote for the directors. They don't ask the management to explain how their profits are going to be sustainable in the long run. And we've had a crisis of short-termism, where I think in the stock market you only got rewarded for things that really made a difference over the next few months. And anything that was about the long-term health of capitalism was seen as an irrelevance. And we need to change the way our pension funds and mutual funds work, so they're actually focused on the 10 or 20 years' time when we'll be retiring and want to spend our retirement money, and we'll hopefully live in a society where business has actually improved how society works.
How do you change things, though, like the belief in the short term? I've been hearing this since back when Japan was wealthy and we weren't. They would say, well, that's because they have this long-term view. Toyota, the late Toyota, looks, you know, at the long-term view, so they're not making the wrong kind of cars. This was the, you know, sort of the 80s argument, whereas we're very short-term oriented. How do you change that kind of what is really a culture?
Well, I think part of it is about us as consumers demanding more from the people who we give our money to for retirement. We actually say to them, you know, explain how this is going to make sense as an investment strategy over the 10 or 20 year horizon. Another change is in the law. A lot of pension funds and mutual funds are trustees. They're supposed to act as prudent long-term investors in the interests of their customers. The government could actually bring a lawsuit under the Department of Labor and Pensions to challenge how many of these institutions have failed to actually look after our long-term interests, failed to vote in elections, failed to actually demand better people in charge of our boards. You know, you think about Lehman Brothers and what went wrong there. Year after year, their board was being rated as one of the worst in corporate America, and yet no one did anything about it. It had an actress and a Wall Street impresario, and mostly one person that knew about finance on the board of Lehman Brothers. So then we get surprised when it goes bust.
What else do we learn when we take that big step back that you say most people aren't doing, but you guys have done in writing this book? What else do you see that needs enormous changes?
So the other area where I think a lot of problems were highlighted by this crisis was that there's just general financial illiteracy at every level of our society, including in the media. I mean, I hold my own hands up there. We all got carried away in the bubble. And I think certainly boards of directors, there were too few people who really understood the financial strategies that their firms were taking. Congress, a lot of people don't really understand the basics of how economics works. And I think for a modern democracy, you actually need to have your citizens understand economics, and we need to have a crusade to put financial literacy at the heart of our education system so that we can actually start to take some of these long-term decisions that our society needs.
By the way, if you have questions or suggestions regarding watching your pension fund evaporate, do call us. And it's Marty Goldenson sitting in for Brian Lehrer today, by the way, but our phone number remains the same at 212-433-9692. 212-433-9692. WNYC, if you have a question for Matthew Bishop, who is U.S. business editor of The Economist and also has just written with Michael Green, The Road from Ruin, How to Revive Capitalism and Put America Back on Top. You write that we are tracking our economy all wrong, that short-term profits don't mean that there is long-term value, and rising share prices from companies don't mean that they're necessarily more valuable. I mean, that's pretty shocking.
It is. One of the things that we looked at in the Great Depression in the 1930s, which surprised me, was that actually it produced this extraordinary revolution in how the economy is measured. So for the first time, we started to get GDP statistics compiled that actually allowed policymakers to know whether the economy was growing or not. I think we need a similar data revolution today, because it turns out we've not measured very well how our economy is going. And some of the things we celebrated, like GDP seemingly growing way above its long-term average, turned out to be an illusion, that when we go back and look at the data over the last 20 years, it will turn out that we didn't grow as well as we thought we did. And so we need some supplementary data. We need the same for stock
but
prices.
There are a lot of people out there saying, you know, this is, there's not really value there. And isn't it partly a psychological problem that people want the optimism, and they don't, and we ignore those people who say this whole thing is going to collapse? It's a house of cards.
That's right. Human psychology does. We are optimistic creatures, and I think that's one of the best things about capitalism. It's an optimistic system, and that's why I think when we argue in the book that the worst thing we could do at this moment would be to jettison capitalism. But that doesn't mean that we need to be foolish optimists. I think we can improve how the system works so that it does deliver kind of long-term economic prosperity, rather than getting caught up in this rather short-term blitz of optimism that was turned out to be based on sand.
I think we have a short-term, long-term kind of specific question from Frank in Manhattan. Frank?
Hi. I'm sort of fascinated by your comments earlier about how institutional investors look at the market and how they're not thinking long-term. So does that mean that the concept of buy and hold is dying? And my context for this is, when I look at volatility charts sort of since the Internet's created, it just looks like the volatility, there's so much volatility in each individual stock. I'm wondering if that's the only way we're creating value, is just this constant trading of stocks, and there is no buy and hold like my dad taught me.
I think you're onto something. One of the statistics that amazes me is that every share on the New York Stock Exchange changes hands every 10 months nowadays. In the early 1980s, it was once every 3 years. So you can see how quickly short-termism has grown in our investment system. You know, Warren Buffett, who is a genius, he tends to buy companies that he wants to keep holding forever. And I can't expect an institutional pension fund to be as good as Warren Buffett, but I would like them to actually be able to say to me, I'm investing your money in companies that we'd still like to be invested in 10 or 20 years' time. And they don't at the moment. At the moment, they reward their fund managers on the basis of how they perform on a one-year basis against their competitors. So, they're institutionalizing with their bonuses a short-term culture that I think is very destructive to capitalism and to wealth creation.
Let's take another call. Let's see. In Montclair, Kylie.
Hi, welcome. How are you all doing today?
Welcome.
My question was, I agree that we need to do more with financial literacy. I guess I'm also wondering how your guest thinks that our overall understanding of capitalism as an economic structure contributes to our lack of understanding about financial literacy as a culture.
I agree. One of the points that we make in the book is that for the last 25 years, the public debate about capitalism has been very caricatured. So there's been this idea that capitalism and markets are good, government is bad. When I think if you actually look at the history, capitalism works best when governments are regulating the markets in a smart way, not in a heavy-handed way, but in a sensible way. And you can't have effective capitalism without effective government. And you hear at the moment the shrill response to this crisis, and people want to go back to that caricature. They either want to say only government is the answer or only the markets are the answer. And I think, in fact, we should be having a debate about how do we get markets and government to work more effectively together. And that's one of the questions we address in The Road from Ruin.
Thanks for calling. Again, it's Marty Goldenson in for Brian Lehrer, and we're talking to Matthew Bishop, who is the U.S. business editor of The Economist and has written this new book, The Road from Ruin, How to Revive Capitalism and Put America Back on Top. One of the ways in which and obviously you want that balance you talked about between regulation and letting the market do its miracles, which is, generating new kinds of wealth all the time, which is pretty remarkable. But one of the things that your book's been attacked for is naivete. People have said, well, you think that what we need to do is also get more ethical, that if you're selling mortgages on the street there, you can't take, I think you put it as the Nuremberg defense anymore. My boss told me to sell this and as many as possible, and he's paying me per mortgage. And even though I sense this person will never be able to pay it back, you know, I get my fee for selling it, so I'm going to do it and look the other way. Isn't that a naive solution to say that the answer is for the individual salesperson to become ethical?
Well, I think you're right. There was a culture on Wall Street which was known as IBG, YBG. I'll be gone, you'll be gone. People took their bonuses knowing that they wouldn't be around by the time the deal came to be seen as a disaster. So the question is, can you change the incentives in capitalism that actually encouraged people to behave in a more long-term values-based way? I think you can, for a couple of reasons. One is that we as customers of pension funds ought to demand it. And I think if we start demanding it, then the system will change. After all, Wall Street is supposed to work for us, not us for them. The other thing is that a lot of companies now see their future as either being in providing products to people who are increasingly wealthy. And if you're buying shoes from Nike, for example, you know, it's a luxury good. You don't want your luxury to have been made by somebody sweating in appalling conditions in the third world. You actually want that company to say, we're looking after our workers. And increasingly, branded goods companies are saying we will be more ethical because that's what our customers want. Also, many, many companies now see their growth in future coming in the developing part of the world. And again, as those countries get richer, they're going to want to be consumer societies themselves. And if they see a company that's been exploiting their own people, they're not going to consume from that company in the long run. So you're seeing companies like Pepsi, General Electric, Nike, all sorts of companies like that. Walmart has now realized that its customers, you know, want to have goods that are not made in ways that destroy the climate. So they are actually demanding of their supply chain a reduction of carbon in the supply
right,
chain.
So long run is starting.
Long
to
run
come
really
in.
Does work when you let it work. Companies will respond, and so that's one of the challenges in the book. I don't think it's naive at all. I mean, you're never going to get rid of all greed. You're never going to get rid of
behavior. People can see that the long run also is profitable, or is profitable, more profitable perhaps. Things will go that way. I have to cut you off because we're out of time, but if you want to learn more from Matthew Bishop, who is U.S. business editor of The Economist, he's going to be sitting on a panel on our financial direction this Wednesday evening at the 92nd Street Y. That's right, isn't it?
It's the downtown Tribeca 92nd Street
Y. Oh, good. So it's just called 92nd Street, and you can find details of this event at our website, wnyc.org. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me.